Time I use the calculation of the energy carried by a wave packet to and its Lorentz transformation properties to derive the formula that if a particle emits an energy E, then its mass changes by E over C squared. And this was the basis for the formula E equals mc squared, which was so important later. So in order to do that, we use the formulae for the energy density in the electromagnetic field and the Poynting vector. Okay? So I want to show you now that, in fact, these follow trivially from this this general point of view that we should write down tensor formulae, okay, or almost trivially from that point of view. So whereas I just presented these formulae for the energy density and the Poynting vector, it seemed to come out of nowhere. Of course, people figured this out, but if you know the Lorentz invariant notation, it's really very straightforward. And the key concept is the stress energy tensor. And this will come up again and again in relativity. Okay, so when we have a field like an electromagnetic field, and we want to work out what is the energy and the momentum in that field, we always go through the stress energy tensor. And of course, when we come to the Einstein equations, this tensor will occur in the Einstein equations. So for electromagnetism, the stress energy tensor, it's always a symmetric 4x4 matrix, symmetric tensor. And the stress energy tensor for electromagnetism turns out to be this. And you did an exercise on this yesterday, but I'll just recap it for you. Okay, so the stress energy is something which is quadratic in the fields, and it's a tensor. Now, of course, the most important property of it is that it is conserved. And that means that d mu of t mu nu is zero. Okay, so d mu, remember, d mu is just d by dx mu, and sometimes I won't bother putting the x in there. If you have a conserved stress energy tensor, you automatically have a conserved energy and a momentum, and actually you have something else called a pressure, which comes out of the stress tensor. So it's a very unifying concept. So let's just remind you how that happens. When I take the derivative of the stress tensor, remember, I'm going to use the field equations, which is just d mu f mu nu equals zero for when I don't have any charges or currents. And the second field equation is d alpha f beta gamma plus cycles equals zero. Okay, but plus cycles means I just shuffle these indices around in the three different orders. Okay, so let's show that. If I calculate d mu f mu nu, then obviously when d mu hits this object, I get zero, because that's just the first field equation. So that's d mu f alpha mu times f alpha mu. So this one is obviously zero. And then I have f alpha mu d mu f alpha nu. And then from this one, I have minus 1/2, because I have f squared. and I'm going to differentiate one of these f's and leave the other one alone. Okay, so if I differentiate one of them or the other one, I get the same answer. And so let's just put a factor of the factor of 2, and then we get f alpha beta d nu with an upstairs index f alpha beta. Thanks. Okay, so what I've done is d nu with a lowered index, but d nu times eta mu nu is just the d by dx mu, but with a raised index. So it's d nu. Okay, so that's a... So the sooner you get used to basically forgetting about the eta, the better. And just raising and lowering indices. Okay, so what do we want to do? Well, essentially, we want to cancel this term against that term to show this is zero. And what have we got to use? We've got this formula here with the three terms, right? So there are three terms here. And there's this term with a factor of 1, this term with a factor of half. So naturally, we try to express this in terms of two terms, which combined with this term will give 0. Okay, because a factor of 2 relative here. So we can do that by noticing that this is antisymmetric. The f alpha mu is antisymmetric on alpha and nu. And so let's just write that as 1 half here, d mu f alpha nu minus d alpha f mu nu. Okay? When you raise and lower indices, be careful to keep the position left or right clear, okay? So if I have f alpha beta and I write this is equal to f nu beta, right? The beta is still the second index, it's just the first one got raised. Okay, and so now I have a bad sign here because well, the sign here is not correct. In this, by the way, this identity is called a Bianchi identity. And in that identity, all the terms have the same sign, whereas these have opposite signs. So I've got to switch one of these signs. So let me switch this sign, and I'll do that just by shuffling these indices. So this becomes, this is minus d alpha f nu mu. Okay, I just interchange the first and second indices while keeping them up or down. And so now I have a plus. Okay, because I have a minus sign there. Yep.
It's not clear to me how you get that extra term.
This extra one?
If you split d mu f alpha mu out.
Yeah.
Then by the Bianchi identity, shouldn't you get two extra terms?
No. So I was just using the anti-symmetry of f. Okay, so this is antisymmetric. So if I write this in the following way, put a factor of a half. Then this is equal to what it was before, because the second term has the alpha and the nu interchanged. Okay, so I can relabel this mu alpha and flip these two. Sorry, I can... What do I do? The second term would be f mu alpha. If I flip the indices, I get minus f mu alpha times, if I just take this part of it, I'll get d alpha f mu nu. Okay? And now I'll just relabel the indices, alpha and mu, the other way around. Okay, and then combined with a minus sign, I get exactly what I had before. Okay, so that's just using the anti-symmetry. I can always If a tensor is contracted with an anti-symmetric tensor, then I can take the tensor minus the flipped indices, and this is equal to, so this is exactly equal to the original term. So I haven't used any field equation there. That's just an identity. And I still haven't used any field equation. I took this second term here and just shuffled these two indices, the nu and the mu. And now it's almost right, except I still have that minus sign here. So let's just try writing out the Bianchi identity. So if I have, let's compare this with 1/2, and then I'll have F alpha mu times d mu F alpha nu from the first term plus d alpha F mu nu from the second term. I'm just writing out these two terms. I should have put that mu there. And then I want to include this term. And that will be plus d nu F mu alpha. Okay, because here I have alpha beta and alpha beta in the same order. That's the same as alpha mu with mu alpha. So I just shuffled these two indices to get the minus sign. Okay, so just make that clear. This is term 1, term 2, term 3. This is 1, 2, 3. And this is just the, should be just the Bianchi identity with the, you see all that's happened here is that the indices have been cycled from term to term. Is that clear? Okay. So what? So we've shown that d mu f mu nu is zero using the field equations. And what that means is that we now have a conserved, I'll just leave that up there in case you want to copy it. What that means is d mu t mu nu equals zero. Well, just take the zero component of that equation. Yep. No, it doesn't, because I could just multiply this with an eta nu gamma, and that would just put the nu down. And now it's the Bianchi identity. So that's why, as I said, try and forget about the etas. Indices up or down don't really matter for the symmetry properties of the tensors. And you basically the pain of relativity is that the formulae are long and involved, and there's lots of algebra. And so the more tricks you can learn for minimizing your algebra, the better. In fact, I once had a discussion with a colleague who was saying, isn't it terrible that nature works in a way which requires years of experience of calculation to understand? You know, isn't that awfully elitist of nature to work that way? And he was very depressed. This physicist was very depressed about this. He wanted a physics which, you know, the common people could do, and they didn't have to do all this years of calculations. But that is the way it works. But the reason it works that way, you see, the principles which underlie it are extremely simple. Relativity, the basic principles that you can just change coordinates on space-time in a certain way. That's extremely simple principle. But the whole problem is that whenever we actually do a calculation, we need numbers. You know, we're unable to do any calculations without numbers. And so we have to convert this beautiful structure of space-time into numbers, and then we manipulate these numbers. And when we convert it into numbers, it's so arbitrary how we choose those numbers that we end up with this huge machinery to do the calculations. But anyway, so let's see. The stress tensor is conserved. And so what this means, let's take the zero component. There are four equations here. Okay, nu can be 0, 1, 2, 3. So d naught of t naught naught plus di of ti naught equals 0. Okay, and this equation is nothing but the equation for the conservation of energy. Okay, because what I do is I say define rho to be t naught naught. That's the energy density. And more strictly speaking, the energy momentum, I'll call it energy density. And let's define pi, capital Pi. Maybe I'll call it pi I, just so it doesn't get confused with ordinary momentum, is ti naught. And then it follows that if I have some volume V in space, this is a spatial volume, it follows from this equation that the time derivative of integral d3x of rho of x and t, rho of t and x, all right, t naught naught is in general a function of t and x, but the time derivative of that integral is equal to minus integral d3x di pi I. So here I'm just using the fact that I can take this time derivative inside the integral. It's integral over space at fixed time. And so I can just take the d by dt inside. And then use the fact that d rho dt equals minus, from this equation, minus di pi I. Okay? And then we can use Gauss's theorem that this is minus integral pi I. Doesn't really, yeah. Pi I ds I. And this is on a surface enclosing the volume V. Okay, so this is Gauss's theorem. Gauss divergence theorem. Okay, so all that is telling you is that the change of this quantity in time is just due to the flux of pi over the surface. Okay? And so if I pick a surface big enough that there is no flux over it, got some localized process going on, pick a big surface so nothing is passing out through it, then this quantity will be conserved, and that's the energy. So if S chosen, if the surface is chosen, so pi I is 0, no flux, then the energy is integral d3x rho is conserved. I'm just going to leave that one up. And now we're just going to calculate this stress energy tensor, and we'll discover it gives you all those formulae that we had for the energy energy flux in the electromagnetic field. So let's calculate T naught naught. I should put a constant in here. It turns out that with the conventional definitions, there's actually a constant here. As long as you pick this constant the same way, then the equations are fine. So we'll see that now. Just calculate this. I'm going to calculate T naught naught. So this is naught, that's naught. This index has to be I. Sure.
I just want to know what happens when mu equals to 1.
When?
In that equation, we assume that mu is 0.
Yes.
What happens when mu equals to j?
Excellent question. Okay. So you're used to two fundamental conservation laws, right? Energy conservation, and what's the other one?
Momentum.
Yeah, the other one is momentum conservation. Okay. Good question. So basically, T naught, we have D naught T naught I plus DJ TJI equals 0. That's the other one. Now there are three indices. So I've got three conserved quantities. So it follows that PI, I can't actually call this PI because it is the momentum, is D3X T naught I. It follows from this that that quantity is conserved as long as this quantity vanishes on the surface. Okay? That's where momentum conservation comes from. Okay, so the energy density in the electric field, we put 0, 0 here, and this guy has to be I, because F 0, 0 is 0. F is anti-symmetric, so there are no diagonal elements. So this turns out to be Fi0, Fi, I0, that's right. You see, the I indices I can just raise and lower anyway, because the eta matrix is 1 in the ij elements. So often I just raise and lower the i's and j's without worrying about it. The 0 is the one you have to worry about. And then we plus a quarter, because eta 0, 0 is minus 1, minus 2 f0 I f0 I plus f I j f I j. Why did I get the minus 2? Well, look at this term here. When I write out all the possibilities for alpha and beta, alpha could be 0 and beta could be I. That will give me f0 I f0 I. Now, this has a 0 downstairs, so it's minus F0i with upstairs indices, so that's one term. But I could have alpha equals I and beta being 0. That would give me another term, just exactly the same. Okay, and so now we just go and plug in our formulae for this, and this will be 1 half. So you see, I get minus a half here. I've got plus 1, so I get a factor of a half times the electric field squared over C squared. And then from this term, Fij was epsilon ijk bk. And so that term will give me 1 half b squared. And that's exactly the energy density in the electromagnetic field up to a factor. Recall rho, which I gave you before, and it's actually 1 over mu naught times T naught naught, rho from before. Okay, so the stress energy tensor is a very powerful thing. It tells you the energy and the momentum in the electromagnetic field. And likewise, let's work out T0i, because that was the flux across the surface surrounding the region. And so naturally, we expect that to be the pointing vector. Now, that's easy to calculate, because eta0i is 0. There are no elements off the diagonal. And here I have f. So if the first index is 0, I'll have to have fi0. J, I guess I better use, and then I. Okay, and that's it for T0i. And what's that? That's just E cross B, because this is equal to, now Fi0 is probably minus Ei over C. Fji is epsilon Ji K BK. Again, I don't need to be careful about up or down from the for the spatial indices. And so this is, you see the I comes second. And so J-I-K. Sorry, this was a J. Okay. And now epsilon J-I-K is anti-symmetric, so I'll push the I to the first index, and that gets rid of the minus sign. And so now I get epsilon I-J-K E-J over C B-K, and that's just equal to 1 over C E cross B I. And so that's the pointing vector. And so our pointing vector S I is equal to 1 over mu naught, because I had the factor 1 over mu naught for the row. So I better put the same factor in here, times T0i. OK, and then I'll just leave it as an exercise to you. Calculate Tij. And I'll give you the answer, so just check. It requires a little bit of algebra. BIBJ minus EIEJ over C squared plus delta IJ E squared over 2C squared plus 1 half B squared. And this is called a spatial stress in the electromagnetic field. The reason it's called a spatial stress is, you see, I already told you that the conservation of T naught I, as Solomon asked, you know, what does that conservation law lead to? Leads to conservation of momentum. Now, if momentum is not conserved, the reason it is not conserved is because of this guy, right? So I had d naught of integral t naught I is equal to minus integral dj of t j I. And this is the momentum. So the reason it's not conserved is because there's some non-zero stress. And so what is spatial stress? Actually, it's just force. Spatial stress is a force. You see, if you ask, why is the momentum of this blackboard changing? It's because I'm exerting some stress on it. Okay, that's what the Tij is. It actually represents the force which changes the momentum. So that's what this stress in the electromagnetic field represents. So it's, this stress literally pushes the momentum around. Yeah.
About the T naught term, what's our interpretation of that specific term? B squared or C squared plus B squared?
It's the energy density in the electron.
Why do we call that energy density? Because what we got was the integral of it, or all the space, gives a total energy.
Exactly.
Is there any reason that it's already finite and tiny volume, it gives the exact energy inside that?
It's a good question. Strictly speaking, we have not shown that it is the energy density. We've shown that the integral of it is the energy. That doesn't mean that it is the local energy density. So you're right. Now, the reason this can fail is, for example, if I had my stress energy, my T naught naught, okay, and imagine I add some divergence to it, del squared, let's say, it's a scalar. Just say I add that to it. The integral of that is going to give the same answer. If this phi thing vanishes at infinity, the integral of this will be the same. It will still be the energy, but the local energy density will be different. Okay, so you're absolutely right. We cannot infer from this alone that it's the energy in a small body. The criterion for inferring that is actually that this tensor be symmetric. If this tensor is symmetric, then it turns out it's the right one that couples to gravity. And anything that couples to gravity, you can kind of measure its energy using the gravity. And so because this T alpha beta happens to be symmetric, it's actually the right one. But that's not a trivial point. Yep.
Can this stuff be used to explain, because Nima said that there is no such thing as energy conservation. Well, if I think about...
But he's probably thinking about gravity.
Yeah, well, I asked about the photon flying in space.
Yeah.
The space expands, so the photon gets redshifted, so
good.
Energy goes somewhere, but where?
That's a very good question. Okay, so we're kind of going deeper into physics, as you'll see. We're combining space and time, and we're compactifying all these formulae. I've not really explained why energy is conserved. I've just shown you there's this T alpha beta that happens to be conserved. Why was it conserved? The fundamental reason behind the existence of this T alpha beta obeying that equation. What is the reason for that existing? And the reason is that physics, that the space you're working in, i.e. space-time, is invariant under translations. That's the fundamental reason. Okay? So that's kind of plausible because there are four independent translations. I can translate in time, or I can translate in each of the space directions, and I get correspondingly conserved energy, or the three components of the momentum. This is the fundamental reason, and the person who discovered this was Emmy Noether, right, sometime in the 20s. And so she was one of the very few women theoretical physicists at that time, okay? And her discovery was absolutely fundamental. She figured out why symmetries lead to conservation laws. And that, in fact, is the entire basis of modern particle physics, that you build it on symmetries because you want these conservation laws. But anyway, so she figured this out. It's called Noether's theorem, and it says any theory with this invariance will have a conserved stress-energy tensor. Now, where we are, I'm off the point. Okay, so we have an expanding universe, and the energy of a photon is not conserved. Well, surprise, surprise. The expanding universe is not invariant under time translations. So energy conservation comes from time translation invariance. An expanding universe obviously changing in time. So energy is not conserved. There is a version. Now, that's a little bit too glib, because there is something called a pseudo-energy, which can be conserved. It's a very ugly thing, but you basically cook this thing up. You'll find it in Landau and Lipschitz, for example. And it's used in many contexts. But you can often construct something that happens to be conserved in some respects as a kind of stand-in for a team menu. But the strictly speaking, the answer is there is no conserved energy if the space-time is changing. There's still momentum conservation. You see, in a universe which is just expanding, you're still invariant under translation invariance. So there's an exactly conserved momentum. Yeah. It doesn't have to be conserved. energy comes and goes. There are many kind of ways of thinking about it. Like I said, the pseudo-energy, what it does is it tries to explain the loss of energy from the electromagnetic field as the gain of energy in gravity. See, so you can play that off. And when we come to the electron cosmology, you'll see that the energy in the universe changes, but then nevertheless there is a constraint. There's an equation which looks like energy being constant, and that's called the Friedmann equation. That describes that even as the energy of the universe changes, the expansion rate of the universe changes in a certain way. And so you can attribute that to the energy of the gravitational field. But if you give a fixed back, if you give a fixed space-time, all right, and you don't allow the back reaction of the energy on the space-time, the space-time is just fixed, then you'll find no conservation of energy. So when you couple it back into gravity and you allow for the fact that the gravity is sort of changing in response, then there's you recover some notion of energy. But it's a bit weird because it turns out the energy of the universe is zero. There is no energy in the universe. It's conserved, but it's zero. So when people talk about the energy crisis, there's a very simple solution to the energy crisis, to figure out how to use gravity to get energy. Because so energy is always zero. You can get any amount of energy out of a gravitating object. Just make the gravitational energy more negative, and the energy and everything else will be more positive. So, okay. we've gone quite off the track. Are there any other questions, though? Questions are good. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, would you be able to see that somehow?
Black holes. Yeah, black holes. You have a question?
Yeah, I have a. So what is T00?
It's the density of the energy in space.
And what is T0i?
It's the density of the momentum in space. Yeah. So if I integrate it over space, I get the momentum.
And that's just by definition.
That you could say is by definition. That if I've got a conserved stress tensor, I define the energy and the momentum to be these spatial integrals of T00 and T0i. And then I'm guaranteed by this Gauss divergence theorem that as long as I pick my surface to be so big there's no flux across it, then actually the energy will be conserved. All right, good. So now we're going to do, I promised you last time to say something about forces and why force was dp dt, etc. So let's see this. This is another illustration of how powerful this relativity is, because it sort of makes complicated physics, quote, obvious. Okay. So let's talk about the Lorentz force. Okay, if I have a particle moving in an electric and a magnetic field, I'm sure you've all seen the formula that mx double dot is equal to, well, let's say the force is the charge times the electric field plus V cross B. Right? That's one of the standard formulae in electromagnetism. Everybody happy with that formula, right? So does relativity imply this formula? And the answer is yes, it definitely does. Okay, so let's remember, we're not allowed to write down some random formula. We have to write down something tensorially. Okay, something that is obviously covariant or obviously going to be preserved by Lorentz transformations. And so we've got to think in space-time. So I imagine some particle moving on a space-time world line. And it has a 4 velocity given by dx mu dtor. And that's going to be light-like for a massive particle, time-like, sorry, for a massive particle. And so let's try to write down a formula for the rate of change of the 4 velocity. Okay? And I want this quantity, this 4 acceleration, so this is the 4 acceleration, I want it to be obviously a 4 vector. So when I differentiate, I better use tau, because tau is invariant under Lorentz transformation. D tau was the invariant distance between two points along the world line. Okay? And u mu is likewise a 4 vector, because I took x mu and differentiated it with respect to tau, which is Lorentz invariant. So uv is a 4 vector, and this 4 acceleration is also a 4 vector. So I've got to put something on the right-hand side of this equation. It should be proportional to Q, because only charged particles will feel this force. And what else can I put there? Well, how can I construct a four vector from the field tensor, F mu nu, right? How can I construct a four vector? Well, let's try putting F mu nu there. And what's the problem? There's a hanging index, so I better get rid of it. And what? Just put the four velocity. Okay? So let's lower it and put dx nu. Actually, we just put u nu. Okay, so that's good. That's a Lorentz invariant force law. Well, is it the right one? Well, let's work out the I components of it. Now, remember, P mu, the four momentum, was m naught u mu. And so so it follows that dpi d tau, so m naught dui d tau is pi. Sorry, m naught. Yes, that's right. M naught dxi d tau. M naught ui is pi. Okay, so this is dpi d tau is q. And now I just have to work out all the components here. So I get fi naught d of ct by d tau plus fij dxj d tau. And now what I'm going to do is I'd like to convert this tau into, you see, here I've just got this dt d tau. So the force, the quantity that's changing my momentum, has this extra factor of dt d tau. And I'd like to get rid of it. So that's easy. So let's multiply this by d tau dt. Just multiply the equation by d tau dt. And now I get dpi dt equals q. And then here I have, of course, EI. FI0 is EI over C. I get a C from there. And then I get epsilon IJK B K. And this will give DXJ DT, okay, which is VJ. So VJ is DXJ DT. It's just the coordinate velocity. And so what does this mean? This is just Q EI plus V cross B I. And so indeed, this is exactly right, the right formula. But notice what happens in the equation is that the force is dP dt, not dP d tau. Okay, if this is the force, then it's equal to dP dt. So note the force is dP dt, not dP d tau. And so if I want to make that momentum very large, if I want to make PI very large, I'm going to need very large electric fields. If I want to do it in a finite time, make P diverge, I'm going to need the integral of the electric field to diverge. And so I'll need infinite electric field, and I'll need infinite energy density to make this particle form momentum and go to infinity. And remember, that's the only way to make the particle go null. To make it go null, you're going to have an infinite electric field. Okay, so I think we are basically done with special relativity. Yeah?
I was wondering, what happened to the zero index on the left-hand side? Why do we have dpi d tau rather than the dp
mu? Because I'm just looking at the spatial momentum of the particle. There's another equation.
Okay.
Yep, we can work out the other equation. It's dp naught d tau. That's the fourth component. And we can see what that gives. So that will give, okay, so just from there, it'll give q f naught I. If this is naught, that has to be I, times u I. Okay, and so what this is q times e I over c. Now u is u is dx I dtor. Okay. And so again, if I convert my tor into t, I will learn that dp naught dt is equal to q e dot v, because v is dx dt. Is that a familiar formula? You used to, what does that mean? What is E dot V? If I have a particle moving with speed V in an electric field, E dot V is the work done by the field on the particle. So this is just the work done. Q E dot V. This is the work done. Okay, that is the force. And so the work done goes into P naught. And so P naught is the energy. Change in P naught is just the work done. There's no work done by a magnetic field because it's perpendicular to the velocity. Okay, so we are done with special relativity. And we're now going to go on to Einstein's next masterpiece, which is general relativity, which took him another 10 years. Okay? But the intuition behind it is entirely based on special relativity. Okay, so general relativity is literally a straightforward generalization of the ideas of special relativity. So the first thing we've got to do is to replace space-time of space-time, let's say Minkowski space-time, okay, so Minkowski space-time was just CT and X with the concept of an eta, which you use to measure distances, and that all of physics should be invariant under Lorentz transformations. And the generalization which Einstein settled upon was all right. This is the problem with working at perimeter. under the microscope. The generalization of Minkowski spacetime was a differentiable manifold. And so what is a manifold? And this is a physics course, so I'm not going to be very formal about this. But a manifold is basically a topological space, okay, i.e. a set. It has infinitely many points. But the most important thing about it is that it should be locally Rn. An n-dimensional manifold should look locally like a piece of flat space with n dimensions. Okay? So what does this locally mean? It means that if I think about some kind of curved surface, okay, that's a sort of mental picture of a manifold, is some kind of, which I can't even draw. Okay, so let's imagine we've got some curved surface, like the surface of a ball. And then at any point on that ball is surrounded by other points. And this collection of other points nearby looks like a piece of flat space. Okay, so for example, if we take this, this cup, the surface of that cup is a manifold, except not at certain points. Down here it gets pretty sharp, and so it's a bit questionable whether it's a manifold down here. In particular, so a sphere, examples, e.g. a sphere is fine. A torus, right? The surface of a donut is a manifold. But what about a cone? Do you think that's a manifold? A cone? Is a cone a manifold? Why not? It has a bad point. Okay. The point up here, if I look in the vicinity of that point, it doesn't really look like flat space, right? In particular, some angle is missing. I mean, you can make a cone by taking a piece of paper and cutting a wedge out of it and gluing the edges together and to get the vertex. And so you've basically lost you've lost a piece of flat space in making a cone. So that's not a manifold. But so that's basically the picture of space-time. Let's consider the set of all smooth objects that are allowed to, wriggle around, but locally they look like flat space. The other point is they should be differentiable. And this is very simple. It just means that the usual operations of calculus should apply. Okay, so basically that's what we want to do. We want to generalize Minkowski space by thinking of a space which is curved, and we'll learn that in a very precise sense Minkowski space is flat, just like Euclidean space, x, y, z. And when you curve the space, you can do it in an infinite number of ways, just like like a rubber sheet. But of course, we're going to be interested in doing physics. This is the mathematical definition of a manifold, that it's locally Rn. But actually, what we want is that this becomes Minkowski 4. Okay, so we're interested in a space-time. It has one minus sign in its eta symbol, which will become the metric. But all that's saying is that locally, at any point of space-time, on this curved space-time, it should look like Minkowski space. So how do you go about constructing this manifold and doing something with it? And at this point, you introduce coordinates. Okay, this is what I was saying earlier. Unfortunately, to calculate anything, we've got to put it into numbers. The concept of a manifold has nothing to do with numbers. I mean, it's a completely intuitive concept that there's this curved surface. How am I going to describe it? Well, I better put some numbers on it. And then, this introduces all the disasters of long calculations and everything, just because we can't think. So if you want to make the next great breakthrough in physics, figure out how to do physics without numbers. Yeah.
Is R4, does it come with a metric that's different from the one we want? Or does it just not have a metric and we put one on it?
Yes, no. When actually these two things are linked together. So when I want to do operations of calculus, I need to have a idea of distance.
Okay.
And when I do that, I will need a metric. So when you construct a differentiable manifold, you need a metric.
So the difference between M4 and R4 only arises if I have a differentiable manifold.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, that's right.
Why we're only interested in the manifolds that are not like cones? Why we assume that in real space time there's no point in like the.
It's a good question, and we're certainly wrong to assume it. Okay, we assume it for simplicity, but when you connect quantum mechanics to general relativity, You haven't done this yet, but you will. When you do a bit more quantum mechanics, you'll learn about path integrals. And basically, quantum mechanics tells you to sum over paths, where the particle in going from one position to another takes any path at all. Then you can ask, what is a typical path that a particle actually takes in going from A to B? Is it smooth? Not at all. Right? In quantum mechanics, the typical path is completely jagged. Okay. It's not differentiable, in fact. A typical path taken by a particle in the path integral is not differentiable. Okay. So now when we try to quantize spacetime, spacetime is this fluctuating membrane. What is a typical spacetime? It's absolutely not differentiable. So the foundations of this field, right in the beginning, you're doing something which is a bit dangerous, and it will later lead into trouble. But nevertheless, for the purposes of describing macroscopic gravity, like Newton's laws or black holes or the universe, this works really well. So you should just think of this. The whole construction is some kind of approximation, right from the beginning. So right at the beginning, it's incompatible with quantum theory. Right at the beginning. Okay. Okay, so we have this differential manifold. As I said, I'm not attempting to define it precisely at all. But it's an intuitive notion of a smooth object. Okay, so there's some smooth surface here. And like the surface of a ball. And I now want to do something with it. Well, what am I going to do? I'm going to introduce coordinates on this object. So we do coordinates. One way of thinking of these coordinates is you pick a patch of the manifold. And in this coordinate patch, every point of the manifold is mapped to Rn. Or we can, I'll leave it as Rn. For the moment, it will actually be Minkowski space when we start putting a metric on and so on. But let's just in general, what is it? When you deal with a manifold, it's locally Rn, and that point is represented in the Rn by some x of p. And I won't put any indices on the x, but there are n components of this x. And so you're mapping the P, which is the physical point, into some coordinates in Rn. And so it's obvious that you should demand various things of this mapping. You should say that every P has a unique X of P, for example, right? If this mapping is good. Otherwise, you're mapping a same point to many points in the Rn. It's clearly something. It's not a good coordinate system. So this thing here is called a coordinate patch. And so now what we do is introduce other coordinate patches. Okay, these coordinate patches are completely arbitrary. You just choose them because they're sort of the easiest thing you can do to make the calculations work. So we have this coordinate patch, which I will just label by x. Okay, so in this one, this is the x coordinate system. Let's call this one the x prime coordinate system. So this is within this patch, I'm basically laying down. You know, one way to think about it is that this mapping into Rn, what does it do? Well, it associates a number with every point, okay? And basically, it's putting a grid on the manifold. It's a grid which is actually the rectangular grid in Rn, but on the manifold, it'll look like some kind of distorted grid. And so I'll have x prime. I should have picked that point to be in common. Let me put P in the common region. Okay, so there are many coordinate systems. So there's x of p, and then there's x prime of p. And of course, in this third coordinate system, this very same point is being mapped to x double prime of p. So this is the x double prime coordinate patch. This is the x prime coordinate patch. And that's the x coordinate patch. Now, it's crucial that this whole picture of covering the manifold with patches is consistent. Okay? So, for example, in the intersection regions, where many coordinate patches cover the same set of points, the coordinates should be compatible. Okay, that means if I have some coordinate x, and so I can describe this particle either with a coordinate x, or with x prime, or x double prime. Now, so x double prime has to be a function of x. And x prime has to be a function of x. So between these coordinate patches, there have to be mappings, okay, backwards and forwards mapping. And basically, one requires that these mappings are invertible, differentiable, and continuous at some level. And so we have a picture like this. I could describe the particle with coordinate x. I could change to x double prime, or I could go from x to x prime, and then from x prime to x double prime, and I better always get the same answer. Okay? So we must have x double prime of x must be, so for this, for, we must have, must be the same as x double prime of x. That's what this formula means. So it basically means that if I chose one coordinate system, changed coordinates to another one, changed to a third one, or if I just went directly to the third one, I should get the same answer. So we must have this in the triple overlap regions. Okay, so this is a very important consistency formula, that I can change all these coordinates, but I better make sure that they obey this equation. And by the way, if I have this condition to be true, then it's easy to see that no matter how many coordinate patches intersect, they will all be consistent, right? Because I could construct some other one, x triple prime, and then map this guy to that guy. And now I need this diagram to be consistent. But if this diagram is consistent, I can just collapse it to that one, and this one is consistent. So basically, any larger set of coordinates will always be consistent, providing this triple overlap condition is true.
You mean you're applying x double prime to x prime?
Yes, I mean that the coordinate x double prime of some point is given by just taking the x coordinate and working out this function. So it's saying the x double prime coordinate is some function of the x coordinate. And the idea of a differentiable manifold rests on the existence of these functions. You have to have a manifold, then you have to have a set of coordinate patches, and then you have to have these functions which map between the coordinate patches.
Yeah.
and we require that they're differentiable and that they satisfy this identity in the triple overlap regions. Okay, so these are all sort of very intuitive notions. Just that I should have all my coordinate systems should be consistent and should be describing the same fundamental object. So let's do an example, e.g. a two-sphere. So that's clearly a manifold. You can't get a better manifold than a sphere, right? It's perfect. Finite volume, it's smooth locally, so if I draw the sphere, you know, and I work near any point, that certainly looks like a piece of flat space. If I work very near that point, it's just a piece of flat space. How do we put coordinates on a sphere? Okay, well, you've done this, of course, many times, and the natural coordinates on a sphere, well, natural, the sort of standard coordinates on a sphere, are the following. We use polar angle theta, and then for a terrible diagram here. Okay, if I pick some point on the sphere, then we will have polar angle theta and azimuthal angle phi. Okay, so or we represent the sphere as the set of points x squared plus y squared plus z squared equals 1. That's a two sphere in three dimensions, and then we say x is equal to sine theta cos phi, y is sine theta sine phi, z is cos theta. And so for any theta and phi, this obviously satisfies this equation, and my two coordinates are theta and phi. What's wrong with those coordinates? They're pretty singular. Where are they singular? And the south pole. Okay, so these are singular coordinates at the north pole and the south pole, because why would you say they're singular? Cos phi can be anything. Okay, it's because the same point is represented by any phi between 0 and 2 pi. So the north pole has theta equals 0, but any phi. I can't tell what phi it is. So clearly it didn't satisfy the condition I wrote down, that every point should correspond to a unique point in Rn. So the Rn here is the theta and phi, right? So we have our Rn. If this were a good coordinate system, let's see, theta goes from 0 to pi, phi goes from this is theta, phi goes from 0 to 2 pi, and the problem is that this coordinate system is singular along this line. We can fix that very easily by picking some non-singular coordinates. Okay, so an example of non-singular coordinates would be projective coordinates. So let's take our sphere, and draw a plane through its equator. So just take the sphere and draw a plane through the equator. And then what I say is take the north pole, and if I want the coordinates of some point on the sphere, let's say that point I've labeled x, I draw a line from the north pole through that point x until it hits the plane. And this new plane, the plane will have coordinates, let's draw them like this. So this will be x1, and then that is x2. This is x3. I just chose a point on the sphere which lies in the x1, x3 plane, just to make the diagram a bit easier. But you see, I could pick any point and then just shine this ray of light from the North Pole through that point to hit the plane. Should what? The sphere, yes, the plane is supposed to be going through the equator of the sphere. Okay, apologize for my drawing skills. So just take the sphere, put a plane through the middle of it, and then connect a line from the North Pole to the point in question, and extend that line till it hits the plane. And so then what I do is I pick coordinates on this plane, which are just two. So the coordinates on the plane are z1, z2, right? So every point on the sphere will be mapped to some value of z1 and z2, except for one point. So this is now singular at only one point instead of two. Where is it singular? Yeah, the North Pole. Because if I draw a line from the North Pole to the North Pole and extend it to the plane, I don't really know what I'm doing. So, or better to say that, yeah, it's a singular case. So the North Pole coordinates, projective coordinates, cover the whole sphere except for the North Pole. The South Pole projective coordinates will cover the whole sphere except for the South Pole. And then we'll have the overlap region, which is in fact the entire sphere, apart from the North and the South Pole. Okay? So those will be our two coordinate patches. So you can easily work out what are these coordinates. Again, I've embedded the sphere in three Euclidean dimensions here. And I'll just leave it to you as an exercise that z1 is x1 over 1 minus x3, and z2 is x2 over 1 minus x3. Okay, and basically this follows from similar triangles. So this is a North Pole projective coordinates. And we similarly have South Pole projective coordinates, and they would be just gotten by reversing the x3. x2 over 1 plus x3. Okay, the x1, x2, x3 are great coordinates. I mean, they're global coordinates. The sphere sits there, and any point just lives at some x1, x2, x3. The problem is I only want two coordinates, right, to cover this two-dimensional manifold. And as it turns out, it's impossible to cover a sphere with one set of coordinates. There is no set of coordinates which covers the whole sphere in a non-singular way. Yeah. It does cover it, but not in a non-singular way. So non-singular means that every point on the manifold should have a unique image in the coordinate system.
But in the theta phi system, each point is singular.
The North Pole corresponds to this line. So it's a point on the manifold, but actually corresponds to a line in the space of coordinates. That's bad. You can't have a point mapping to a line. It doesn't. You've got to have points mapping to points. And, you know, this leads to real problems. I mean, if you try to do calculus on a sphere and you come to differentiate, you'd find things like 1 over sine theta d by d phi. And that sine theta is going to 0. And so it'll give you disasters in the calculus. So you have to pick your if you want to differentiate, you must pick your coordinates to be locally one-to-one and locally like Rn. Okay. So this is a better set of coordinates because they only have one singular point, but they're still not perfect.
That different plane was somehow
would work.
It also holds, but
yeah.
And then for the North Pole, you can just assign one of the points that are not being that has not been used.
Yeah, but you're just mapping the problem on a sphere to another sphere, which has the same problem.
Can you just add one point and then?
The sphere, it has problem that all the points of the plane has been used when you reach the North Pole,
right.
So you cannot assign any point.
That's true.
But when you bend it, you have all the, because you know, not all the points have been used. You have still the points.
You need to show, but you need to show me that the point at the North Pole goes to one point in the new coordinate.
Oh, we cannot arbitrarily assign that.
Well,
we're not allowed to.
Yeah. So, what is a set of coordinates? A set of coordinates maps you from the manifold to Rn. So I've got to be able to map my sphere, every point of the sphere, into one Rn. Okay, in a non-singular way, one R2. It's a two-dimensional. It has to be one to one. So every point on the manifold must go somewhere in the Rn. Now, you don't have to cover the whole Rn. Say we take a torus. You see, a torus you can cover. So what do I do with a torus? A torus looks like this. Right? It's a donut. The torus, if I want to cover it with coordinates, actually very easy, because all I do is I cut it along the equator here, like that. Let's do it even simpler to see. Cut it around here. All right, I just cut through it, and now it's a cylinder. Open it up, it's a cylinder. And then I'll cut the cylinder along its length. So the torus is nothing but a flat object. If I think about this as being smooth, then I can bend it around. Okay, so this torus, but what happens is on the torus, this edge is identified with that one. Right? So if I run out of here, by this point, it's actually the same point as that one. Okay? And so I would come back there. Now, likewise, if I run out there, I would come back here. So we just draw this diagram. This is a torus. Okay? So just a piece of Rn with identifications is topologically equivalent to a torus. And as a space of points, it is a torus. And now we say, can I pick coordinates which are locally Rn, okay, at every point? And if you regard this as a subset of the plane with this identification, then yes, it's true. It's locally Rn. There's no problem. So with the torus, there's one coordinate patch that fits in Rn, and it's one-to-one. Every point has a unique image and satisfies all the right properties. Okay. Do you know what this is? Almost. That's the Klein bottle. One of them is the Klein bottle, and the other one is the projective plane. Okay. I've forgotten which is which. I'll leave it to you to figure it out. Okay, but the sphere you can't embed in, you can't cover with one set of coordinates. Okay, so we have some, at least some impression now of what a manifold is, and a few examples of manifolds. So let us try to start doing some tensor calculus on manifolds. So we have our picture of a manifold. We have some point. This point gets mapped to a coordinate. This is x of p. And now I want to consider objects which are functions of these coordinates. Okay? So remember, the objects really live on the manifold. I mean, these are supposed to be physical things. Okay, but in order to describe them at all, we had to introduce the coordinates, and then we define these tensors to be functions on these coordinates. It's really a tragedy we have to do physics like this. But it's the only way we know how. Okay, so what does that mean? So it means that that x, we have a function of x of p. So this would be, for example, this would be a scalar field. Okay? A scalar is a tensor with no indices. Okay? It's just a function on the manifold. So you just think that I go across the manifold, and to every point, identify a number. Okay, that's what this scalar field is. But in order to actually do this, we introduce some coordinates on the manifold, and then we consider this function to be a function of those coordinates. Now, of course, what we'll have is if we have two coordinate patches covering the same point, we have to make sure that our scalar function agrees in the overlap region. Okay, so in this coordinate patch, the x patch, I will have phi of x of p. This is my point p. Well, let's, okay. But in this coordinate patch, the x prime patch, I'm going to get phi prime. It's the new version of phi in the prime system of x prime of p. Okay, that's what I... So I've got this object, this function that lives on the manifold, and I want to make sure it always agrees, no matter which coordinate system I choose. And so what I have to insist on is that these two things are the same. In other words, the definition of this scalar phi in the prime coordinate system is that its value must equal the value in the unprime system if we're talking about the same point. Okay, so notice x prime is not equal to x. I mean, the coordinates are a completely different set of numbers. But for that different set of numbers, I better make sure that phi agrees. Okay, so this is the definition of a scalar transformation law. Is that phi prime of x prime is equal to phi of x. Now we have vectors. We have two kinds of vectors. One is contravariant. And the example of a contravariant vector you can think of as the four velocity, for example. So say I have some curve on this manifold. So I've got my some curve, which is x mu of lambda. Right? So I really think of this curve living on the manifold, but of course I pull this all over to Rn, which is the local coordinate system. And now I have a curve in my Euclidean coordinate system, x mu of lambda. And then example is dx mu d lambda is a contravariant vector. So things like the four velocity and the four momentum will be contravariant vectors. And the transformation rule of these objects is easy to read off from here. So v mu prime of x prime is equal to dx prime mu dx alpha v alpha of x. And you see, often I won't put the indices on this x. What this means is that there's an argument. There are four arguments here. There's t prime, x, y, z, x prime, y prime, z prime. There's t, x, y, z. Those are the arguments of the vector. And then we have covariant vectors. and the typical example of a covariant vector is just the derivative, d by dx mu, e.g. And d by dx prime mu, you know from the chain rule, is just dx alpha dx prime mu d by dx alpha. If x prime is a function of x, then d by dx prime is just dx dx prime times d by dx. And so you see this, this vector transforms in the opposite way to the covariant vectors, to the contravariant vectors. So in general, we define covariant vectors so that w mu prime of x prime is dx alpha dx prime mu w alpha of x. So this is just the same as when we were doing Lorentz transformations. And in fact, Lorentz transformations are a special case of this, where the manifold is Minkowski space, and those dx dx primes are just the lambda matrices. Notice that that these two matrices are actually the inverse of each other, that dx prime dx alpha dx dx prime, so if I work this out, beta, that's equal to dx beta dx alpha, and so that's delta alpha beta. Okay, so these two are inverses of each other. Yeah, it does. The definition of the Lorentz transformation was that V mu prime was lambda mu alpha V alpha. That was the Lorentz transformation for an upstairs index. And then for a downstairs index, it was that W mu prime was lambda twiddle mu beta W beta. And so that's exact, or if I put alphas here, that's. So this is the lambda twiddle, and that's the lambda.
But doesn't the lambda also have to work in on the x in the argument?
Yeah, but I haven't. It does. It does work on the argument. Okay, so in this formula, when you do special relativity, and I actually did this when I computed the energy in that wave packet, I transformed the formula, the coordinates too. So the correct definition of the Lorentz transformation is you transform the tensor and its arguments. And this formula is correct with the lambda in there. Okay, so here I would say this of x prime is this of x. That's the right transformation formula for the stress energy. So, you know, when we computed the stress energy tensor, we said F alpha beta prime of X prime is lambda alpha mu lambda beta nu F mu nu of X. That's the correct formula in special relativity as well. So this is really just lifting the special relativistic formulae into the general case. And this is much more general. You see, the special relativity case is just the case where x prime mu is lambda mu alpha x alpha, meaning that x prime is a linear function of x. In the general case, it can be anything. It doesn't have to be linear. It can be any function at all, provided this mapping is sort of well-behaved. And in fact, the mapping being well-behaved essentially amounts to, so the x prime of x is well-behaved, provided dx prime alpha dx beta is invertible. Okay, and basically that means that you can go between the x and the x prime coordinates. And both matrices exist, the x dx prime dx and dx dx prime. Just as a mnemonic of these terms, trees grow up. Okay? And so contravariant indices are up, but valleys go down. And so covariant indices are down. Okay. And I already showed you an example of something with an upstairs index and something with a downstairs. Sorry? Covariant. Yeah, valley is down. So. Oh, co is low. But where's up? Oh, co is low. The other is up. That's fine. Co is low. And oh is up. Okay. All right, so similarly, a tensor of valence, this is just a little bit of jargon, valence MN, this simply means the number of up indices, and this means the number of down indices. Okay, so we can have tensors which obey the following transformation rule, T prime alpha beta gamma dot dot dot, and there are M of those, and then mu nu dot dot dot, and there are N of those. And this is T prime as a function of X prime is equal to dx prime dx. This is would be with a dx prime alpha dx mu dx running out of letters, rho, and then we've got dx dx prime. This will be psi mu dot 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 t rho dot 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 mu dot 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 x. Okay, so every upstairs index transforms with a dx prime dx, and every downstairs index transforms with a dx dx prime. I'll put another one in there just to make it a little bit. Dx delta, t rho delta. Okay, so there are m factors, and these are n factors. So that's the general transformation law for a tensor. And then there's another bit of jargon, which is that the rank of a tensor is m plus n, just the total number of indices. And then there's some basic laws of tensor algebra, okay, which are that if T and S are tensors, then 1 T plus S is a, let's see, of the same rank. Tensors actually of the same valence. Then T plus S is also. You can add tensors because the transformation law is linear. And so the sum of two tensors, providing they have the same valence, is a tensor of the same valence. And then you can do outer multiplication to get a tensor from other tensors. So for example, if I have T alpha beta dot dot dot, and I have T, and I have S mu nu dot dot dot, and there are m of these and n of those, that's still a tensor. I could just multiply two tensors, it's still a tensor. But what's happened is that a valence m0 with a valence 0n has become a valence mn. And then third, you can have contractions. Okay, so T alpha beta gamma dot 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 times S alpha beta delta dot dot dot, where there were M indices here and N indices there, then I've got something of valence M minus 2, N minus 2. And of course, number 2 and 3 rest on this property. Okay, when you have indices which are contracted, then the upper index will get a dx prime, and the downstairs index will get a dx prime dx, and those will cancel. And that's why that's why the valence will decrease. And then there's a very useful fact, which is completely obvious to state, but in fact is very, very powerful, which is that if a tensor vanishes in one coordinate system, then it vanishes in any coordinate system. Okay? Because if t was 0, then when I calculate t prime, I just get a bunch of dx dx prime factors times t. So if t was 0, t prime is 0. And the corollary of that is that if I have two tensors and they're equal in one coordinate system, then they're actually equal in any coordinate system. And that's often useful. In fact, I used that at the end of the last lecture because I computed the energy of that packet of light in the frame where the observer was moving by working out what it was in the frame when the observer was stationary, or vice versa. But basically, if you compute some Lorentz invariant in a product, you can work it out in any frame, and you're guaranteed that it will be equal. So a scalar, you see, if a scalar quantity, if two scalar quantities are equal in one frame, then they're equal in any frame. Okay, so I think we will stop there. And tomorrow we will start a discussion of the metric.
So just as a reminder, there is no tutorial.
It's a colloquium. So please come to the colloquium.